This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm honored to have in the studio with me the Zen Buddhist monk and peace activist, Claude Anshin Thomas, who's just written a powerful book called At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace. He is also the founder of the Zalto Foundation. The purpose of that foundation is to bring awareness to the culture of violence in and among individuals, families, societies, and countries. It supports all efforts to attain this goal through whatever peaceful and nonviolent means available. Claude Anshin Thomas, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Yes, thanks. It's great to be here.
Tell me about your journey, which is fascinating and riveting to and harrowing to read about, because you go to Vietnam. How'd you end up in Vietnam?
We only have 29 minutes, so I'll do this as succinctly as I possibly can. Actually, if you wouldn't mind, I would read.
Sure, that's fine.
Out of the first, not of page four of the book. So when I turned 17 and my father suggested that I go into the military, I didn't question him. I also didn't know much about politics. It wasn't part of my life. Now I understand how important it is to know what is going on in the world. Though no long-term solutions to our world's problems are achieved through political ideologies, I am impacted by them, as is each of us. And a dear price is paid because of this kind of ignorance. My father, like most men in my town, had served in World War II. When that generation talked about war, they didn't speak truthfully. Unable to touch the deep and profound wounds that war had left inside them, they talked about war like a great adventure. And what I make an effort to do what I do in the book is show the roots of violence, the roots of war, and the roots of suffering. Suffering is just a generic term used to identify a craving to anything outside of me that will make me well, or the blaming of external events for the source of my individual struggle. So I show the roots of this and how they're transmitted. My father was a soldier in the Second War, my grandfather in the First, my great-grandfather in the Spanish War.
And you tell a harrowing experience of your mother pushing you down a flight of stairs.
Throwing me down a flight of stairs with a bicycle on top of me, 20 steps. That's only one story. The reason I talk about these, write about these stories, and I talk about them candidly, is that my story isn't particularly unique. These were stories that were shared by most of the kids that I grew up with, and they're stories that I hear repeated today in society and culture. It's how anytime I see something external to myself as a source of my struggles or the potential relief from my anxiety, I mean, isn't it just great when I can look out and see someone homeless on the street who's nameless for the most part? I can say that's the source of my problem, so I can go out and just beat the crap out of them, because then I can unload this feeling of shame, discomfort, tenseness, alienation. I can blame them for the source of all my difficulties. That homeless person is not the source of my difficulties. They're a result of my being unwilling to deal with that. And so while I blamed my mother for years because she was the primary perpetrator of violence against me as a child, not my father. My father's violence was different. It was a lack of emotional connection, a lack of support because of his own inability to process how he was affected by the causes and conditions of his life, his service in the war. I tell these stories because it's important for people to know where the roots of violence are, and that they are transmitted. What happened in my family happens in families all around the country. Happens in families here in Madison. It happens in families in the neighborhoods that we grow up in. And somehow when this becomes public, we're shocked, but yet it's happened to us.
I'm speaking with Claude Anshin-Thomas, Zen Buddhist monk and author of At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace. And so you volunteered to go to Vietnam.
Well, yes, I did. At my father's request. I joined the military when I was 17. My father signed the papers.
And you tell a story in the first few days of training, you dropped your rifle. What happened then?
What happened is that I was setting my rifle down in the stack. You've seen it in the films. They stack it in this, looks like a teepee kind of shape. And I don't know what happened. My rifle fell. The stack fell over. And the drill sergeant, as I envision him now, he must have been 25 feet tall. But in actuality, he was over 6 feet, I'm sure, standing right up in my face, jamming his finger into my chest, screaming all sorts of obscenities to me, something that happens with regularity in military training. And then out of the blue, or at least it seemed out of the blue, he whipped out his penis and urinated on me. And in front of everybody, the shame and embarrassment that I felt were overwhelming. The guilt that I felt was incredible, and I didn't feel like I had an effective form of response to that. So in swallowing all of this guilt, shame, this embarrassment, this humiliation, then it became channeled externally on that which I was being taught was the enemy. See, the enemy, in my case, the Vietnamese, were being portrayed as cardboard cutout targets, as bags of straw or burlap bags stuffed with straw that I was stabbing with bayonets. I was being trained and conditioned through my being dehumanized to dehumanize others, because it is impossible to commit acts of aggression against others without dehumanizing. And through that process, I lose contact with my own humanity. That was happening to me as a child, in the family I grew up with, in the educational systems I was exposed to, on the athletic fields where I played sports, because running out to the football game on Friday nights from the locker room, we chant, kill, kill, kill. And I say this not as an attack against, but rather just to acknowledge that was like that. So it made absolute sense for me then to follow my father's lead, to follow the lead of all the men of his generation that I grew up with, who most of them served in the Second War, and join the military. I wanted to go.
And you went, and it turned out you were a very able member of the armed services. You write very early on, right at the top of this book, that you were directly responsible for killing several hundred people. And how did you process that? How did you come to terms with that?
Not very gracefully. And I don't know if there's ever a coming to terms with it in a social sense. The most important thing in this process for me is, one, to acknowledge that I did do this, and that it's not okay to kill people, because even in the monastery where I trained for 3 years, when I asked the question, I said, how can I, because we talk a lot about atonement, how can I atone for these actions? What can I do? Because it is also about doing things different, about living differently, not about thinking, adopting ideology, blaming. It's about me doing things differently in my own life.
You have a very poignant passage where someone is telling you, I believe it's at a monastery, that if you blow up a bridge, you need to build a bridge, but then you ask, what if you kill a person? Yep. You can't bring that person back to life.
Yes, precisely. And that was where I was going. And when I asked the question, the response that I got was, well, you weren't really responsible. You were much too young and you were just doing what you were told. I already knew that that wasn't true. Now, I knew then that I couldn't get an answer, and that the only way the answer came for me was through a disciplined and committed spiritual practice. Now, I don't want to mistake this with religious, adopting religious ideology and that sort of thing, but a disciplined spiritual practice, which means adopting certain aesthetic principles and structures that will help me to live differently, so that I can experience transformation of the consequences of my actions, healing not being the absence of them. So I have this. I had this awareness that, you know, I'm not a good or a bad person because I killed people, but I am responsible. And so now, what do I do? Without answering that question, but just staying engaged in the tools, the spiritual practice which sustains me, which in this case is Zen Buddhist practice, being engaged in this, not separate from life, but living in an integrated way with life. I mean, it's a great myth of Buddhist practice that it's only about the I, the individual, the self. It is true that only I can work with the fabric of my life. But I do that in an integrated way because I know that I'm not separate from you. I'm not separate from the society I live in. And the moment I start separating myself, that's not at that's not the spirit or at the root of the practice at which I engage in.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is the Zen Buddhist monk and peace activist, Claude Anshin Thomas. His book recently out is called At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace, where he reveals some of these things that happened to him and that he did in Vietnam and how he got from there to here. Mm. I just want to stay with that question about Buddhism and individual focus for a second, because sometimes I think, and even when I read this book, you wrote, Vietnam is only an expression of something that begins inside each and every one of us. And I wonder sometimes with the focus on the individual that I see sometimes in Buddhism, whether that focus minimizes or obscures other causes of Vietnam as nationalism or imperialism or capitalism. There are religious wars as well. Can they all really be reduced to this individual attachment?
Well, I don't look at it in terms of individual attachment. I experience war as a collective manifestation of individual suffering. I would say capitalism as a collective manifestation of individual suffering. I mean, political systems are made up by individuals. And the system without those individuals has no identity in and of itself. So I don't see the struggle being with the political system, but rather the individuals which make it up. So you heal the individuals, and the system takes care of itself. Now, I'm not suggesting in any way that people don't become socially active, and because it is through social activity that I begin to become more conscious of what is my conditioning. If I'm staying out on the street and I'm screaming and yelling at somebody, looking at them as the problem, that's already a manifestation of war, but from another perspective. If you ask me a pointed question and strong feelings rise up in me, you're not the problem. In that point, you give me an opportunity. Give me an opportunity to work with these strong feelings in a different way rather than blaming you. Because, of course, that was what happened to me as a child. It's what happened to me as a soldier. When I came home from Vietnam, discharged from military hospital, in my uniform, awarded and decorated, walking across Newark Airport, a young woman with a peace medallion hanging from her as a necklace at the small of her throat, spit on me.
And you write that you thought she was coming to embrace you.
Oh,
she
I saw
was beautiful.
The movies.
You thought, this was your welcome home parade.
Yeah, well, I saw the films, I saw the movies, I heard the stories my dad told, the other guys told, you know, and that's what we dreamed of. That's what we wanted to happen. That wasn't the truth.
How were Vietnam vets, how were you treated as a vet other than that particularly disgusting experience?
Well, what I can say is also, I will address that question because it is a very good question. And I just want to say in conclusion, I don't blame that young woman. She's not the problem. And what I understand is she was working. This was an acting out of her conditioning. Now, what can I do to help people renounce fanaticism? When I came home, the people who were, there were still, the majority of people in this country when I came home in 1968 were still in support of the American policies in Vietnam, still in support. And I think even when the war came to a conclusion, when we withdrew troops, I think if you would have polled, you would have still found the majority of people in support of, although I don't know that for certain. What I will say is that when I came home, those people who were in support of wouldn't give me jobs. I couldn't get hired. Now, it also didn't help that I followed my father's lead and the generations before him, and that when the tensions around my service, the memories, the feelings, the sense of isolation, the not being able to sleep, when those things arose in me, I followed their lead. I anesthetized rather than talk, because, of course, the moment I started to talk, you could see people disassociate, their eyes would glass over, they'd get anxious and nervous, and they'd look at their clocks, they had had an appointment, they weren't able to listen, they didn't want to listen, because it brought them in contact with their own culpability. So, I couldn't get hired, but also, you know, if you've had a half a pint of liquor before you go for a job interview, it doesn't help. And so I had all of these things happening at once. I went to the Veterans Administration, and this is not a knock on them, because they were confronted with the same dilemma them as they are now. Funds are being cut, staff is being cut, and they're being overburdened with the number of people that come in. So they're limited in what they can do by the resources that they have, but they didn't provide me the support I needed, the help that I needed, the services that I required, and still it's a fight. And so I see all of this. What can I do in the midst of this from the place where I stand to help people get to a place of change, a place of transformation? And that's it, by recognizing these roots in me and helping people to renounce fanaticism, not attempting to impose some ideological position on them.
Do you view the Bush administration as a fanatical administration?
Well, what I often say publicly is that George Bush is not the problem. And George Bush is simply not awake. And what can I do to help and support people who are trapped in the ideology to wake up?
But
by blaming it, I mean, I think you see it take place on the streets. You start blaming and attacking somebody, and what's the reaction? They get defensive, they get entrenched, they blame and attack, and no movement is made. What you've done is you've got the same situation as you had in Vietnam, where no movement. You were just accepting the status quo of violence.
But doesn't it seem very difficult, Claude Anshin Thomas, to get George Bush or Donald Rumsfeld or Dick Cheney to a point of mindfulness?
Well, I don't really know. Perhaps if people, the only reason they're in office is because they were elected. I mean, if we want the world to be different, we have to do things differently. So how do we get out? I mean, how do people who think the world ought to be different, what do they do about that? You know, why don't they get themselves elected to school boards? Why don't they get themselves elected to city governments? Why don't they get themselves into jobs where they can write about what's happening, like yourself? Why can't they talk about the truth? I mean, I didn't know about this 2-minute that you read about what's happened in Ramadi with this film.
This was this film, Ramadi Madness, about U.S. soldiers who were celebrating the kicking of a bound soldier in the face.
And it's not – those aren't bad people. That's a consequence of war. I was a helicopter crew chief. I crewed slick ships and gunships. Slick ships carry people into battle and out of battle, did extractions, did medevacs. One of the things – when I crewed gunships, one of the things that we used to do is a crew of 12, three gunships, 4 people per helicopter. One of the things we used to do is we would get together before we took off. We would pool our money. Those with the most confirmed kills at the end of the day would collect that money.
Oh, so you had a bet.
Well, it was like a pool. But that's what happens when we become – to commit acts of violence and aggression, we must be detached from our own humanity, because to do that, we have to dehumanize the other. They become faceless, nameless cardboard cutouts, and it is a place where we can act out our conditioning. So it was that was a perfect place for me to act out all of this conditioning that I had inherited from my mother, from my father, through what happened in my family, all that I experienced in school. The Board of Education was a prominent Board of Education. That was the wooden paddle that sat in the front of the classroom. When I went to school, corporal punishment was the rule. It was the rule.
That was the physical Board of Education.
Yes, the physical. Yeah, where the teacher would beat you if you didn't do what they thought you ought to do. And so it was a perfect place for me to act all of that out, because I I also thought I could act it out and get rewarded for it.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Claude Anshin Thomas, author of At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace. What do you think the legacy of this Iraq war is going to be as far as U.S. soldiers returning?
There's absolutely no way to know. We can't. I mean, you can look at the consequences of people in my generation who served. I don't know what – I haven't been to Iraq yet. I really want to go. So I don't know what they're confronted with, the soldiers there. I can't imagine what it must be like. Well, I can imagine, but I can't know the specifics. But I can know that we as a country, I think, in attempting to deal with what we feel was the injustice, the social injustice served against Vietnam veterans by not welcoming them home, we're getting too far to the other side. You know, I didn't need parades. I didn't need people to stand up and applaud. Because that just trapped me in my own shame and guilt. I feel, how can I ever talk about the reality of what happened when these people think that I'm this great guy? Because I can't tell them the truth of what my experience was like. We need to ask these people to talk. We need to get their stories. We need to encourage them. And when we're listening to them, it's going to put us in touch with some uncomfortable feelings inside of ourselves. These soldiers are not the problem. They are a manifestation of the collective expression of individual suffering. I think the greatest, most important message that I learned in this process of my own awakening is that violence is never a solution, never. Violence only gets more violence. Hatred only gets more hatred. Greed only gets more greed. War is never an effective form of conflict resolution. War only ensures that we're going to have more wars. We can stop this. We can have peace. Peace is not the absence of conflict. Peace is the absence of violence within conflict. In order to live this reality, we must be able to engage in conflict, be aware of our own aggression, our own self-centeredness, our own conditioning, and not react, not project that onto others. Now, how we do that, how we live that without a disciplined practice is difficult, if not impossible. I know you want to say something.
I'm just jumping up here with the question that always confronts the pacifist, which is when someone who is a pacifist says war is never the answer. The question then is, what do you do about Hitler? How do you stop the Holocaust? And how do you wrestle with that? You've been to Auschwitz.
Well, I was ordained in Auschwitz. I was ordained at the site of one of the crematoriums, and then I walked from Auschwitz to Vietnam. I've also done other pilgrimages. Since 1994, I've walked about 15,000 miles. You know, I live without money. I don't have a home. I live outside. I'm really dependent upon the generosity of others. If people don't offer me food, if they don't offer me a place to stay, I sleep outside and don't eat, and that does happen. And I then bow to them in gratitude, thank them, and find the best place I can to sleep.
It's tricky, Auschwitz, though, that the Auschwitz question is a hard one.
Well, actually, for me, it's not so hard. I mean, what happened then happened. Violence was used to end a military struggle, to bring a conclusion to a military struggle in Europe. The larger question is, did it? Is the war over? And of course, the answer to that question is no. Violence was used to stop a Holocaust that needed to be stopped. Let there be no question about that. But then the larger question for me is, have Holocausts, have genocides been stopped? And the answer to that question is no. What I want to do, and what my commitment is, to bring an end to war, to bring an end to Holocaust. And I believe that, well, I don't believe, I know from my own experience that violence is not a solution.
But was there a particular way to stop that particular Holocaust without using violent means?
Well, you know, I wasn't born yet. I can't really speak to that with any authority. I can only echo the sentiments of Gandhi, who was alive during that time and was engaged in his own nonviolent struggle. And Gandhi said, yes, it could have stopped. It would have required a great commitment of courage. We would have required, it would have, you know, people would have died. But in the end, it could have been stopped through nonviolent measures. And in the end, that kind of stopping has a more more long-lasting or more substantial effect on the very fabric of war and violence. I would also say that nonviolence, and I got into this discussion with the editor of the book, who was very instrumental in this book being having the quality of expression that it has. I mean, she really supported me and demanded that I articulate myself in a clear way, and she really helped me with that. But we got into this discussion because I say that I'm not a pacifist. I'm a proponent of nonviolence.
And what's the distinction you draw?
Well, the distinction I got from reading, from doing study around Gandhi, and really the statement came from him. Gandhi experienced pacifism as people avoiding conflict because they are afraid of the consequences, whereas manifesting the reality of nonviolence is knowing that I have the capacity to act in violence and I make a conscious choice not to. And so what I encourage people to do is to, and I do this with the book, is to invite them to look at the 10,000 ways in which war manifests itself. In this country alone, according to a University of Chicago study, each year we kill in this country between 27,000 and 39,000 people with guns. Now, you take that times 2.5, which is the length of time we've been involved in Iraq, that's already 2.5 times 27,000. The conservative brings us up to 60-some thousand 500. We've killed... American deaths in Iraq are over 1,500 now in 2.5 years. 67,500. That's a war by any other name. And look at the ways in which violence expresses itself in our own homes, in our own cities, in our own job places, and really work. I'm not saying ignore what's going on over there. That would be a travesty. But to really wake up to the roots of violence in us and begin to live our lives differently. And if anyone has any questions on how to do that, when they buy the book, on page 168 of the book is my personal email address. And the publishing company thought I was crazy. I'm the only author that they've ever published who's put their personal email address in the book. People can write to me.
Do you want to give it out right now?
Sure. It's Anshin, A-N-S-H-I-N, at... Sprynet, Sprynet.com. But I will tell you, if you want to write hate mail to me, I'm just going to delete it. So if you have legitimate questions to ask, I'll respond to you.
We only have about 30 seconds left. What do you urge people to do who want to engage in peace activism and nonviolence?
I would say that they need a foundation and a disciplined spiritual practice. And if they have questions about what that is, they can write to me and ask. But there are a number of models for them. Thomas Merton was a model for them. I'm not saying that one has to take robes, one has to become ordained, but it is, and it's not glomming on to some religious ideology, whether it's Buddhist, Islamic, whether it's Jewish, whether it's Christian, whether it's indigenous. It's not glomming on to some intellectual ideology about religious practice. It's really adopting a disciplined practice that will help them to live differently in the face of their own violence.
That's going to have to be the last word. Thanks for being my guest.
Oh,
Claude,
you're welcome.
Anshin Thomas, author of At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace, and founder of the Zalto Foundation, which you can reach at www.zalto.org.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.